from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Joe Kutz, the protagonist of Louise Erdrich's new novel, was 13 years old when his mother was brutally raped on their Native American reservation. Her new novel, The Roundhouse, centers on Joe's story and how he searches for justice while trapped between tribal laws and desire for revenge. A New York Times bestselling author, Louise Erdrich joins us to talk about her characters in The Roundhouse. It's the second book in a planned trilogy that began with the 2009 Pulitzer Prize finalist, The Plague of Doves. The novel is a National Book Award finalist, and she'll join us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. Louise Erdrich joins us in this forum hour, the author of 13 novels and a number of volumes of poetry, short stories, and children's books. She won the National Book Critics Circle Award for her early work, Love Medicine. Plague of Doves, which we discussed with her when she was last with us on forum, was a finalist for the Pulitzer, and it preceded and is linked to her most recent novel, part of an ongoing trilogy, her 14th, called The Roundhouse. Louise Erdrich joins us in studio for this forum hour. I'm so glad to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here, wearing all my clothes. And, you know,
you have problems with nudity up there in Minnesota, too, huh?
Well, you know, that we have a kind of self-correcting nudity problem where it turns to November and everybody puts their clothes on. So we don't really have a year-round problem up there.
It's like the Occupy movement. The weather keeps things under control to a great extent. But you said there's a beach near your bookstore?
Yes, we have the only nude beach in Minneapolis, right down the street from our bookstore, Birchbark Books. And we get a lot of people riding back and forth and people bicycling back and forth to the new beach, but we don't get a lot of customers. Most of our customers just go into the bathroom and we don't see them for another hour. It draws a lot of disparate elements.
But not too many nudists. Not too
actually,
many.
Actually, yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah. It's the only place. I mean, where else can you go in Minneapolis, you know?
Well, I noticed you said Birchbark Books. I mean, yeah. Your branding, your marketing. I mean, I remember when it was just a gleam in your eye, and now
you are. I said an insane gleam in my eye.
Well, it was a tough thing for you to put together, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It was very tough to put together, and many mistakes were made in the beginning. I did not have a business plan. In fact, I thought that the people from the nude beach might be literary people, and
you were mistaken.
They were mistaken, but we have very literary neighbors. We've survived, and that's the story now. That many small bookstores have survived and popped up, and have the support of communities. People are starting to realize that we do a lot more than sell books. We run events and we're good neighbors, and people like to talk about books, come in and talk about books.
And the chains are not annihilating you like was the case a number of years ago, because they're having big problems economically.
Right. Well, I think if you go to a bookstore partly because you're going to go to a place that has personality, that reflects you somehow. And a chain bookstore, it misses out on that because it's all the same. So you might as well go to Amazon, and that's the problem that they've had. If you're supporting a small bookstore, you've got some kind of allegiance to your bookstore. That's what we've found, that people will travel across the city, down the state, up the Mississippi. You know, they'll paddle to us to buy a book.
A lot of it is
because
it's also the name Louise Erdrich. But I was thinking to myself, how many bookstores would, and I, in all
disclosure, I've never been in your bookstore in Birch Park, but I've read about it and we've talked about it. Mm-hmm. How many bookstores are there in the United States that have a canoe and a confessional in them?
I don't know. We don't know that yet. And we've taken a poll, but we stopped keeping ours. We call it a forgiveness booth now. And I think it says we've had to stop people from coming in and sitting in it. It says something like, please do not enter. Our insurance doesn't cover damnation. You know, it's just been a great little place for people to come and sit. I don't know why, you know,
I want to
become forgiven.
Talk to you about those two sides of your identity in the course of this hour. But first I want to talk about this new book because it is, you really know how to write a page turner. I mean, you know, they're great literary figures and you are one of them who open a whole world for us and give us this mythopoetic universe, as it were, a cosmos. I mean, but don't necessarily do the plot stuff that can make you want to just turn the pages.
Well,
you do it.
I like doing that.
Yeah, I know you do.
I really do. It's partly for me. But in this case, I was haunted by the political situation, that the underlying situation that this book in its events refers
Let's
to.
Let's mention it again, the Roundhouse.
The Roundhouse. Yeah. The Roundhouse refers to a situation where it's very difficult to prosecute crimes of sexual violence on reservations. So I wanted to get this going as a suspense novel so that people would be pulled into it, want to read it, and get a sense of the history, why this is the case, and what's happening today in this book.
It's for educational purpose, in a sense.
It was for educational purposes alone, to make a suspense novel that people wanted to read.
You're like Kingsolver. You know, I mean, she said to me on a couple of occasions, I just want to make people turn the pages so they'll learn from what I have to tell them, whatever that may be.
But
this is also a story that's told, we've got the perch of time, but it's really a 13-year-old boy, Joe, your protagonist, and the sense of getting into the head of an adolescent boy. I mean, you do men pretty well, I must say. I mean,
Thank you.
Even going back to Love Medicine, I used to say, boy, she's really, you know, she knows the way men think and all that. But here, you know, you convince us with this voice. There are times when I think, could he really be that canny and smart? But I have to remind myself, this is told from a perch of
right.
time.
Right. Yeah. So I've kind of got it both ways, where he's looking back and he's able to comment on the things that are happening to him at the time, but he also sometimes it moves into a pure boy world where they are doing things that are absurd and getting themselves into ridiculous sorts of trouble, and I can just do conversations between them, and they're kind of geeky kids.
They're tricky
lovers,
in fact.
They love the next generation.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the chapters all have titles from the first season of The Next Generation. They've MacGyvered a satellite dish that they can use to pull in the signals that come from as far away as Chicago, and they can see the episodes, and they're excited about each one that comes out. So the chapters each have the title from one of the episodes.
Is this from your own progeny, or you're totally your imagination?
It's totally my imagination, which is weird and warped. So I watch
you
them all
think
on
like a
VHS.
Kid too,
yeah. I don't know. I think I had this kind of freedom as a child, where I grew up in a small North Dakota town where I could, and I went up to my grandparents on the reservation. I was able to have that kind of freedom, roaming the town, roaming the woods, really not having anyone worry about where I was at any particular hour, and being able to explore the world in a very different way that children than children can do now.
And with that, you had, I always liked the story, your father giving you a nickel for every story you came up with.
Yeah, he did.
We have to inflate that, you parents who are listening, who think you can encourage a young Louise Erdrich, child is father to the man. Let's not make that sexist, but that's Wordsworth. I mean, the sense of encouraging you to be a tale teller, to be a storyteller.
Well, that really is what I... That's why the suspense, because I like telling a story. A story has to keep people listening and interested. You know, I like telling something that has an ongoing plot. I diverge from the plot. I make it difficult sometimes to get back to it, but it's always I wanted this one to be tighter and to keep the thread going.
You definitely keep the thread going. There's a sense too. Let's talk about what you want people to learn about those differences, those difficulties of. Because in the afterword, you talk about one out of three women going through sexual violation on the reservations and the difficulty getting justice because of the two systems, the tribal system on the one hand and the law that is outside the tribe.
Yes. And, you know, when I say the word jurisdictional, it just sort of, you know, don't turn off your, you know, don't change the dial because it's just a really, it's tough to explain all this. That's why it's in a book that has a detective kind of mystery to be solved. But there are reasons for this. There's historical reasons for the land being in different hands, and you have to go to the tribal, to the FBI, to different entities in order to find the right person to help you through this system. And how many women are able to actually get this done for themselves, to actually work through this system? That's the first thing. The next thing is that if it goes to the federal level, they have a lot more to worry about than one woman's misery.
Talking with Louise Erdrich, and by the way, her new novel, Roundhouse, has been nominated for a National Book Award winner this year. Jennifer Egan may get pushed out finally after serving 2 years well, that was the Pulitzer. You were actually a finalist with Flight of Doves for the Pulitzer, and I was thinking they didn't decide on a Pulitzer this year. That's
no,
why I
they
mentioned
didn't. That's right.
Jenny Egan in terms of the fiction award.
Yeah.
But you plan trilogies? Do you think, you know, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a trilogy, or is it just that, like, because this is connected to Flight of Doves?
Yeah, it is, and I didn't plan it, but when I was waiting for some sort of story to come to me, waiting with this haunting situation in mind, I realized that I had a 13-year-old talking to me, kind of telling me this story, and I wanted to go with it. And I thought, well, he's the perfect age if I set this in the first season of The Next Generation. He'd be the perfect age to be the son of the judge and Geraldine who get married in Plague of Doves. So it turned out I
was
had
how you pronounce his name, the judge? Basil?
Basil. Coutts. Right. Yeah. And so it ended up, yes, it's connected thematically. And as I wrote this, another one came to mind, and I thought, I'm going to write yet another book, and it'll be perfect. It'll be three books, and it'll be connected by this particular theme, somewhat about the same people.
You have staked out territory here. I mean, in terms of it's what Faulkner called my little postage stamp of reality. Instead
right.
of Yakna-Potawha County.
Mm-hmm. And you can say it.
No, but I mean, you've got the genealogies, you've got the myths and the connectedness in the stories and everything. It's rich. It's, I don't think there's anybody else doing this, really, at the level you're doing it since Faulkner.
I don't know. Maybe that's why I get this. I do have this question sometimes, whether I've been greatly influenced by Faulkner or what it is. I suppose I have, but I also am somehow, because I never left North Dakota till I was 18, I put down all of those formational memories as a child there. And so I keep going back to them. The most convincing people seem to come from where I grew up.
There's an old saw about writing that, you know, if you have enough material in your youth, you can mine it for the rest of your life.
Is it really? Well, I've never heard that, but maybe that's the case for me. But my parents still live there, and my family's there, so, and my reservation's there, so I go back all the time. I don't live that. I live 3 hours from the border, so.
You have certainly mined a great deal of material from the reservation, from your own experiences, and also from the Germanic side of your family. I mean,
oh yes, absolutely.
Where does the French come in, though? Because I think your mother was half French,
right? So the French have been turned into semi-native people, the Métis, and that was the interesting that happened during the fur trade. You know, French voyageurs came over sort of looking to get wealthy in the fur trade, and in order to make alliances that would be profitable, married Ojibwe, mainly Ojibwe, Menominee, mostly Algonquin women, and in that way got turned into native people. Their children became native, and they joined in. Now, this is very different than any other, really than any other set of Europeans who came over. You know, certainly the Puritans did not marry into the tribes they met. It was a very different sort of world, and so it's an ongoing culture. It's like a Creole culture that exists out in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, North Dakota, into Montana. And some of the people here have some French words that still to this day exist in their language.
That sounds like Creole.
Yeah, it is.
We're talking, by the way, with author Louise Erdrich. Her new novel is called The Roundhouse. She'll be at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center at 2 p.m. today, and at the bookshop in Santa Cruz at 7 o'clock, a full day and evening for Louise Erdrich. There's the Ojibwe people were known as the original people. Where does that name come from?
It comes from Anishinaabe, and that's the Anishinaabe Moin is the language of the people, and it's being revived at a very, with very great intensity right now, because the language was really nearly wiped out with two generations of people going to boarding schools, so that now young people have decided they're going to go into immersion schools. One of my daughters is an immersion school teacher. She's working. She's managing.
Learning Ojibwe.
Yeah.
So it was my daughter. I told you. She studied at the University of Michigan. Yeah.
And it's a huge movement to go back and really revitalize the language. Yeah. It's interesting.
Well, and so needed. I mean, these indigenous people's languages, tribal languages are disappearing, mm-hmm. and the whole culture is embedded in them. I'm not going to get on my soapbox here, but I think we feel the same about
it. We feel the same way about it, that there is a whole world view that is very important to understand and to communicate in. And when people speak Ojibwe, for instance, there are very few nouns. They're mostly verbs. And it's a language of doing and of community and of seeing instead of seeing the animate and the inanimate in the world and seeing a spirit that really flows through everything.
It's like we were talking to Sandra Cisneros yesterday, who I should mention, these two writers saw each other, and Louise happened to be here as well, and it was like, well, it was really lovely to see the kind of embrace and affection that they have for each other.
Yeah,
but,
it was great to see
her. You know, she talks about the material and the spiritual world not being different, you know, with respect to, say, something like magic realism.
Right. Well, I think that's very much... but it also has to do with Catholicism, because as I grew up, I really believed that miracles should be part of everyday life. I really believed all of it. In Ojibwe, the Ojibwe world, of course, the spirit does move through everything, and you have a sense that there is a living spirit. Even the word for insect. Manaduns, it means a tiny spirit. So everything is alive.
Even bugs are spiritual.
Even say you see a stone, the word for stone is animate. It's not inanimate. It's animate. It's got an animating spirit.
You talk about your relationship to Catholicism now. I mean, I always see in my mind Sister Leopolda, you know, trying to drive those demons out in Love Medicine.
Right. Well, in this book, there's... I have a very different character, a priest, Father Travis, who is a former Marine, and he's very good at shooting gophers, and he's also a very complex individual. The boys spy on him. It's 1988, so he's watching aliens on a VHS player, and they're shocked that he probably owns this VHS tape. You know, they're just, and he's drinking a Michelob, and Joe says, "Oh my God, it's almost enough to want to make a boy want to be a Catholic just to watch this priest." So he's a sign of the outside world coming onto the reservation and being somewhat more sophisticated than anyone's ever witnessed a priest being. Plus, he's in great shape. You know, he can...
He's a Marine.
He's a Marine. He can outrun anybody.
in good shape, and I suppose you could say urbanized now.
Right,
or
right.
Assimilated in ways that that come through just with the hybridization of what you've described as this particular character, which is Michelob. And,
yeah, and so they're watching him thinking that perhaps they suspect him of a crime, but it turns out it wouldn't be possible for him to commit this crime. But they have this, they get basically tossed around the room by this priest. And I just had a lot of fun writing him because in a way he's a comical figure because of his enormous strength and the way that they don't quite anticipate being caught, tossed, creatively obscene names without ever... using a bad word.
Well, these are boys that remind one almost of like Huck and Tom, you know. I mean, adventure and sleuthing and everything, except that, of course, it's a grim story and it hits so close to home. But
exactly.
You manage to bring in these comedic elements. And, I mean, sometimes you're really quite funny, and even though the story is really quite grim. I found myself, in fact, just not, which is a good sign, particularly when you're writing a suspenseful note, not knowing what's Louise going to do next with me here, you know, as a reader, shifting me around.
Well, it's partly that, you know, the elders in this story have incredible license to tease, to be, to talk about their erotic pasts,
got a pretty hot grandma here, in fact.
Right. She has some great memories that she enjoys sharing. We have a 112-year-old great uncle who has not given up on his love life. Yeah.
And why do that?
Why?
I mean, especially in an era of Viagra, right?
Yeah.
talking with Louise Erdrich.
Oh, well, this was 88, but he's going natural.
Not with the ring, necessarily. We're tying in our 2 hours here. I'm going to invite those of you who are listening to join us. We're going to talk more about The Roundhouse, which is a novel that really stays with you, and with Louise Erdrich, one of our leading contemporary novelists and short story writers, poets, really a major literary figure. And we do welcome your participation in the program. Many readers of Louise Erdrich's who are out there listening, who may simply want to join the program, you may want to talk about the differences between tribal justice and the justice that is rendered when it is rendered outside of the reservation, the whole world of Catholicism and Native American worlds coming into conflict and juxtaposed to each other. That's really the world of Louise Erdrich's. Join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls. And again, the toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And please join the conversation. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. We'll return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Louise Erdrich, author of a new novel called The Roundhouse, and she'll be appearing at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco today at 2 o'clock and later on this evening at the bookshop in Santa Cruz at 7 p.m. And it's a story of a brutal rape on a Native American reservation and the son, Joe Kutz's 13-year-old boy, who is the narrator's attempt to find out really what happened and to seek justice. It is, as I said, a very compelling novel. And I was saying to Louise off air, those of you who remember, nobody calls you Karen anymore, do they?
Yes.
Do they?
My parents do sometimes. And I was at my 40th high school reunion in Wahpeton, North Dakota, and I'm still Karen.
Still Karen. Yeah. I was Mike at mine.
Yeah.
But I was talking with Louise, those of you who remember the history, she was married to Michael Doris, and they used to write together on books, and there were some tragic events that occurred, including his suicide. And just, it's a tough question to ask, but whether you've grown more since his death and since, well, you two split up. And
right,
in many
well,
ways,
that happened pretty much simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so, I can't really say. I think that my growth as a writer has been to decide in the past two books that I wanted to tell a story straight through with one narrator, basically. And that's been a very interesting development for me because I used to work with these multiple narrators and break up the book and break up the narrative. And now I'm getting these voices that just want to continue, so I just go with them.
Let's go to some calls here, and we'll bring Tamara on. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Tamara.
And, Tamara, sorry.
Hi, Louise. I'm from Santa Cruz, although I'm in San Francisco right now, and unfortunately I can't come and see you tonight at your reading because I'm at another bookstore that you've been at in the past, Capitola Book Cafe. But
yes.
I want to let you know that your novel, Tracks, is my favorite book. I try to read it annually.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
Of course, my favorite character is Floor Pillager, and I'm wondering if you're ever going to resurrect her voice as a minor character, perhaps, in another book. I miss her dearly.
Well, I was surprised to be writing about Fleur in a book called The Painted Drum. I realized that I'd never written about her origins, and so I wrote backwards to find out where she came from. So if you haven't read The Painted Drum and you read the middle of that book, you'll find out why she is who she is.
Could I ask you, Tamara, why this character appeals to you so much?
I think her... To tell you the truth, it is her origin, Louise, so I'm glad you recommended that. Is the Painted Drum a young, a YA novel?
No, it is not. Oh. It is, it's a grown-up novel.
Actually, remember the conversation we had about The Painted Drum when I said this is a non-linear novel, and
it's
you laughed and said, I'm a non-linear writer at the time.
and I also, she's full of surprises, and that era, the early 1900s, where you first introduced the reader to Floor, is enthralling for me. So keep up the wonderful work.
Oh,
I will read.
Thank you.
I will read The Painted Drum. I'm sorry I can't see you tonight, but thank you for at least coming to speak to us on forum. And thanks, Michael, for bringing her.
Thank you.
Thanks for
good
calling.
To hear from you.
Thanks
we appreciate the
calling.
Call. Go to another call in just a moment. But this is...
You know, I forgot to tell her that Four Souls is the continuation of Fleur's life. So there's another book that does continue Fleur.
You could always find, you know, you can open this new book and there's Nana Push. I mean,
right, and there's some
keep
of his
coming
origins.
Back.
Yeah.
But this is a book, the new one, The Roundhouse, really, where you're struggling not only with justice and how it's rendered, but it's really a book about revenge and about retaliation.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it's, well, it's a book about where you are forced to go when in the absence of justice. And that's why Joe, the narrator, who is just 13, remembers this summer of his life so with such searing clarity. He remembers that he takes on the burden of justice for a system that's broken and for parents who are fragile. And he has to realize this, all of this in one summer, that his parents are not capable, strong individuals anymore. And he's the one who decides to make decisions regarding justice.
What happens to his mother after the rape? This place that gives the book its title, Sacred Place, in fact.
The Roundhouse is a sacred place.
Yes.
That's right.
But it's, I mean, your rendering of what happens to her, I mean, she really falls into pretty bad depression. Everything is close to the mark, it seemed to me. I mean, did you read any case studies, or did you just essentially know this from what you had learned and picked up?
No, I knew this from knowing, women.
From life.
From life, just from life. And I knew it was not something that people sort of think, well, I mean, women get this tremendous violation to deal with on their own sometimes. I mean, it's thought to be something that a woman has to just get over somehow. And I've even heard during my book tours, women have said, you know, I was just told, now you learned your lesson. I mean, there's been this incredibly shocking, I think, discussion of is there a legitimate rape? You know, this kind of discussion has come out during the election.
Missouri Senate candidate, yeah.
Exactly. So she is trying to get over this, but it is a family tragic. It is a tragic family situation. She can't get over it. She's healing any way she can. And she really can't leave her room. I mean, she really has what would be termed now post-traumatic stress. Just that she isn't.
And agoraphobia.
Agoraphobia. She has things that would have a name, I suppose, now, and maybe had a name then. But for her, that's just how she's trying to get over this, by not moving, by not going anywhere, by not eating, by, you know, just remaining still in one place.
Now, this all, as you said, takes place in 1988, whereas the Plague of Doves, its predecessor, takes place in 1911. Mm-hmm. And yet, as I said, the two are linked.
They're linked. So, and I think, and the link here is a legacy, a historical legacy, in which justice is difficult or impossible to obtain, and what that does to a community.
So we're talking about a family, a community. Mm-hmm. A tribe, people.
Right. And what that does to a young person who decides that the burden of solving this is upon him alone.
Let me get another caller on. Amy, join us with Louise Erdrich. Good morning.
Hi, I'm so honored to talk to you guys both.
Thank you so much for calling.
I'm a huge fan, and I'm really excited. I didn't even know you had a new book out until I jumped in the car and heard the radio. So I pulled over.
Oh, glad you pulled over.
I kind of have I don't know if it's a silly question, but I've always wondered, I've been keeping up with your books. Sorry, I've got a two-year-old.
Oh, that's very nice.
Stop, please. Please stop. I wanted to ask you, which character out of your novels you most identify with? I don't know, which character? I'm a writer myself, and I find it hard not to put myself into almost all my characters, but is there a specific character from a specific book that you feel you most identify with?
Right now, I'm still in Joe's character, and I completely identified with Joe. And his friend Cappy as well. So sometimes when you leave a book, you wish that it wasn't over. I mean, I had such an extraordinary experience in writing this book of being pulled along.
You were inhabiting him, weren't you?
Yes. Or he was inhabiting me. I had. So this last character, I haven't been able to let go of him yet. And he's... Right now, he's my favorite. I wish I was still writing the book, I guess.
Amy, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you this morning. By the way, if you'd like to join us with Louise Erdrich, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. And you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. It's a listener named Megan who writes, I just wanted to thank Ms. Erdrich. 2 years ago, I entered a fiction contest for writers under the age of 30, sponsored by the Kenyon Review. Ms. Erdrich was the judge, and she selected my story, Death Threat, as the winner. I cannot begin to express my appreciation for her support of my work. Since the contest, I've been signed by an agent. My first novel is being shopped around to publishers as we speak. I thank you, Miss Erdrich, for giving me my big break as a writer. I have always admired your work and can only hope for a career as distinguished as yours.
Megan, I'm so delighted to hear that. You know, I would never have known. And a writer from San Francisco, in fact, Kay Boyle, someone who
I know quite well and
exactly,
love very dearly. In fact.
She did the same for me.
Oh, I didn't know
Yes,
that.
She
yeah.
did. She chose one of my stories for the Chicago Magazine Prize, and it's with Studs Terkel, and it started me on Love Medicine. So
Kay Boyle, early on in my career as a broadcaster, said, "You purify the airwaves," and I've always held that, cherished
it
like
that's
you can't
wonderful.
Believe. I mean, it sounds vain to mention it, and I don't mean to sound vain.
No, it doesn't sound vain, but it
made me feel so good. I can't tell you.
Something she would have said, yeah.
Well, she was also a real, you know, what disturber. I mean, she was a head of Amnesty International. She was out there on picket lines and, you know, constantly involved in political things of one sort or the other.
Yeah, whenever I came through San Francisco, I'd go and visit her, and she had a huge stuffed white orangutan for my youngest daughter, and she would have something for each daughter. And I also was so touched because it was during a drought, and she was so careful. She was conserving water. She was watering her plants out of gray water that she'd kept in her bathtub. She's just like my dad. That's what my dad does. You know, very much the person who would live as she said people should live, you know, constant conserving care with everything she had.
And also kindness. Enormous integrity and kindness.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
she
great
was a very kind woman.
And her intelligence.
Well, you know, you're known for your kindness and your generosity with young writers and mentoring young writers and so forth. Sometimes it strikes me that it must be, particularly with a writer of your stature, it gets a little bit sometimes overwhelming because you want to give a lot, and yet there's so many who want you to give.
Oh, well, I have four daughters, so between all that happens in my family, very complicated family life, there are these moments where I get to do something that would benefit another writer. And when I meet or read something like Megan's story or like a story that just jumps out, then it's so worthwhile. It's wonderful to be able to bring someone else along the same path.
Well, I remember you were somewhat surprised with Love Medicine. You got a letter, fan letter, really, from Philip Roth.
I was so shocked. I thought, I didn't know. And Toni Morrison also helped me a great deal. Toni Morrison and Philip Roth, Kay Boyle, and Peter Matheson. I got this help from these established genius writers. I was coming out of nowhere, and the book came out of nowhere. It just arrived in they had a stack of books about a mile high, and somehow they picked it out and read it and responded. I've never gotten over that. That's something that I feel like I want to give back.
Well, you have gratitude, and that's a good thing to have, especially for a writer who has made her mark like you have. I'm also wondering about the tendency that literary folks have to often categorize, you know, Louise Erdrich, Native American writer, mm-hmm. Sherman Alexie, Leslie Marmon Silko, Scott Momenday, you're all kind of bracketed, you know, as mm-hmm. Native American. And yet, you know, the tribe histories are so different and the diversity is obviously so mm-hmm. wide-ranging. How do you respond to that? Or how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm of mixed, here I am, of mixed heritage, I'm of mixed mind, you know. Sometimes I think it's really useful because a lot of these books have gained in recognition through the academic world. And in order to do that, you have to group books together and present them as a course. So the books are also read in women's or multicultural studies, you know, all sorts of courses. And at the same time, I really feel that the books have a transfiguring humanity that reaches across all cultural barriers, and that Sherman's books do this, and Leslie Marmon Silko's books do this as well. I mean, there just are Native writers who you read as human, other human beings. So,
universal storytelling. I mean,
yes,
new stories
of course,
having universal themes to them and
so
forth. And yet, you want to preserve the identity too. You want to keep it in some ways native. Many of you know.
Exactly. You have. I think when a writer writes thoroughly out of an identity, that adds depth and richness to a story. But it's really no different from the way any writer writes out of their own background. I mean, Toni Morrison writes out of her background. Russell Banks out of his. Philip Roth out of Newark. You know, it's something that you have to do as a writer. And everyone's categorized, actually. So,
I remember Toni Morrison was once asked by Bill Moyers, probably somewhat mistakenly. He said, "When are you going to be moving from the margins? You know, in other words, writing about people of all colors, or writing about maybe he meant white people. I don't know what he meant exactly, but she scolded him. You know, and she said, you have to come to us. You know, we are not the margins. We are now part of the universal." And I think he felt somewhat chastened by that. There's Barbara, who writes, "We adopted our Native American daughter at birth from her birth mother, who refused to allow her child to be adopted by a member of her tribe because of her experiences being sexually abused by two of her uncles. Could Miss Erdrich please comment?"
Very difficult to comment on this, but it's a choice that this particular mother made out of her incredible trauma. So it sounds as though you cherish this child and you will protect this child. I don't know what else there is to say about it. It's what a tremendous, agonizing decision.
How do you feel, though, in general about, say, maybe a loving couple adopting a child who is born to Native American parents? There's been certainly a lot of controversy with respect to color. I mean, with specifically black and white, you know, white parents adopting black child.
Well, this is a very difficult subject because the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was passed in 1978, really specifically limits the adoptions of Native children out of their tribal milieu. And there is a reason for that. The reason is that children were basically being snatched out of Native families at a huge rate. They were very desirable. It was really wonderful to have a Native child. In Canada, it would be said, "I want a child with Indian eyes." You know, this was at one time, it was something that was, I've talked to social workers in Minnesota who says, you know, who say, "We just took children." So this welfare act was passed in order to keep tribes in some control of the welfare of and well-being of their own children. But with someone who's had this particular agonizing situation, it's very understandable for that person to say, I can't let my family take over control of this child. So there are so many painful decisions that are made at this level, where people are trying to decide where this child is going. I would not begin to be able to really to give a solid answer on what is best. I know that this is something that judges struggle with all of the time.
Talking with Louise Erdrich again, her new book is The Roundhouse. She is also the CEO and proprietor of Birchbark Books in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And here with us in studio.
I like that CEO. Thank you.
Yeah, or chief executive.
Or something.
You know, it's funny. I heard a story today. I mean, you know, your own background is mainly North Dakota, but there was a news report that George McGovern was failing and almost at death's door, which saddened me. He's been on this program, and he's someone, you know, who I liked a great deal.
Yes.
But I remember a story, you know, maybe you can clarify this for me, where you spoke about supporting Nixon because of some confusion over George McGovern and George Wallace. Do I have that story right?
Well, it's pretty embarrassing because...
It's a funny story, as I recall.
Because I ran into the boyfriend who was working for McGovern at the time and telling me, it was Karen, this is your first vote. Don't cast it for Nixon. And I said, my dad has just talked to me, you know, or just written me this letter. He said, George is a demagogue. George is a demagogue. I really believe my dad has great political sense. Actually, Nixon was... He was so great for Native Americans. He stopped termination and he started us on the path to sovereignty. So I said, I'm voting for Nixon anyway. Later on, I said, Dad, why did you tell me that? What? George McGovern was a demagogue? And he said, what? He said, I meant George Wallace. Having cast my vote, now I'm stuck with it for life.
I mean, your dad is sui generis, even calling Wallace George, you know.
I know.
Tendering to his first name.
No, he voted for McGovern. Everybody did.
When did you become Louise, or why did you become? That was your middle name. That is your middle name.
That is my middle name, and I became Louise one Easter after a few drinks and the decision that it really was a writer's name. And my friend who was... sitting with me said, you know, I'm calling you Louise and that's it. And you've got to go with Louise from here on out. So I did. But also I had been Louise in Catholic school because there were so many Karens. So it was part of my background.
And your parents still call you Karen or Louise?
Sometimes they call me Karen. Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah.
Robert, a listener, says, could you ask your guest to describe her writing habits or regimen?
Sure. I would describe what I can tell you anyway. I write in a small room at the top of the house, so I have to get past a kitchen that's usually in shambles. That's the first order of my day. I take my child to school, get past the kitchen, try not to clean as I go up the stairs, and then when I get up there, I write by hand. And I've been discussing this for some reason. Penmanship has been a big piece of the discussion lately because children really aren't learning to write by hand the way it used to be so important for us. You know, we had these...
I was never a good student on that, but we were at least exposed to it, right?
Not even
exposed to it, I don't think.
Really. No, in fact, it was a very important part of my daughter's education as well. My daughters are in their 20s now. And now it's keyboarding that kids do more often. They do cursive writing and then keyboarding. But penmanship used to be quite essential. And in fact, my daughter, who's now in her 20s, had a boyfriend when she was in the fourth grade. And it was a very sweet romance. But one day it just went off onto the rocks. And I said, what happened? What happened? Why don't you like him anymore? And she goes, penmanship isn't everything. I guess she loved him for his penmanship. Anyway, I write by hand, that was a digression. But writing by hand, I feel, has a certain intimacy for me. And also, I edit. My first edit is by hand. I know I've got something if I can write it out by hand again. And if I have the interest and patience to write it out by hand another time, to edit it the first time by hand, then I know I've got a voice. Because if I get tired of it and my hand just drops out of the task, then it's no good.
So hand is the measure of your work, as it were.
Well, there's a very strong connection, you know, between your writing, the characters on the page, the letters you're forming, your handwriting changes as you're writing different characters. I mean, each book even looks different. The handwriting's different for each book.
But you could get a graphologist to do a whole...
Yeah, I could do a whole thing. But it really makes a difference to me. Of course, later on, I put the after I've handwritten, I put it into the computer, and then it's a time-saving device. I can really use the computer and print out different versions and edit those by hand. But I also have to have a very strong physical presence of my handwriting on the drafts to feel good about the book.
Is the third trilogy in, is it gestating? Is it coming into picture or, I mean, into focus?
Well, it's hard to say. When you're on a book tour, your brain is just focused on the next, whether you can go on to the next venue and still have some lucid thought. Like, I haven't really thought about the book.
It's Thursday. It must be San Francisco.
I know.
But it's it must be embryonic. I mean, in some
it must be there.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping it's there because I've loved working on both of these books now. They've been just almost a magical occurrence for me to be able to come upstairs and find my characters over and over still waiting for me. So I'm hoping that's going to happen again.
Well, I hope so, too. I trust that they will. We've just got seconds left. I meant to ask you, in reading this book, I remember that you, as a young woman, went to Leonard Peltier's trial. And
that's right.
Again, here's a big question of justice. And
yes.
How much did that influence your thinking?
I think it was a watershed for me to be there, to listen to it all, and to understand the roots of the decision were made not in a sense of there was no evidence that was given that connected him to the murders, but it was given out of a sense of fear. I could feel the palpable fear that the jury felt in that room, and I was certainly there as the judge made his decisions and kept that fear connected all through the trial. So the injustice was very clear to me then.
Well, actually, those of you who don't know the case, look it up. You should know about it. Leonard Peltier, Peltier, famous case.
Thank you.
Louise, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Louise Erdrich's new book is The Roundhouse. She'll be at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco today at 2 and the bookshop in Santa Cruz tonight at 7 o'clock. And we're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.